français parce que, enfin, je crois que ce sera trop pénible pour vous de pouvoir m'attendre pendant cette conférence. Mais comme vous avez dit, je comprends très bien le français, je parle aussi suffisamment pour commander les déjeuners, certainement. I will speak English, but don't hesitate to stop me and ask questions if something is not clear. J'y ajouterai probablement des mots français aussi de temps en temps. On verra comment si je me détends, ce sera plus facile. I'm speaking about an issue which has really caused a lot of concern and unhappiness in South Africa, the burning of libraries. And I've used this word burning in two senses. It can be translated, it can be seen as a participe présent and as a gérant, I think, or gérantif. I don't recall the difference between those two anymore, but it can mean libraries which are burning, but it can also mean burning libraries, setting fire to libraries. And of course that is what is much more frightening than burning libraries. And so I will talk today about some aspects of the history of public libraries in South Africa, but I'll concentrate on what's happening now. And these are the 5-6 parts of my presentation, talking first briefly about the struggle for freedom, victory, hope, planning and development for a new South Africa, then disillusion and protest, how the library profession is responding to that, how the librarians understand or try to understand what is happening. Then there's a scholarly analysis of burning of libraries, clinics, and other municipal facilities that has been undertaken by sociologists and psychologists, and I will be giving a brief overview of that. And then, la question pour les bibliothécaires, c'est est-ce que nous pouvons comprendre cela? Est-ce que ça nous dit quelque chose? Est-ce qu'il y a quelque chose qu'il faut faire pour réagir de façon professionnelle à ces événements? So struggle, victory, hope, just three iconic images. An image, probably the most well-known image of the struggle of South Africa during the Soweto protests in 1976. And then another iconic image of South Africa's liberation struggle, the freeing of Nelson Mandela on the 11th of February 1990. And then the hope that was expressed by a peaceful general election and a peaceful handing over of power from the former white government to the new democratic government. And the hope particularly that was inspired by Mandela's ability to bring together people, to create tolerance and forgiveness among the people. Then there was planning and development. There were huge differences in the lifestyles and the facilities of the black and white South Africans. And well before the African National Congress took over as the major partner in the government, a lot of planning had been going on. A lot of that was goes quite far back, was very strongly socialist inspired. The document that was seen in the first few years of the new government as the master plan for developing a new South Africa was called the Reconstruction and Development Plan, the RDP. And it was founded on a whole number of principles, of which I mention peace and security, nation building. It is a an interesting ontological question why nation building is seen as so important in developing countries, but we can't talk about that now. And then, of course, growth, development, reconstruction, redistribution, reconciliation, democratization. It was a very idealistic document. Of course, there had been some editors at work, and I'm using the word editor not as éditeur, which in English is translated as publisher, but as the gens qui, who are editors, who change a document to finalize a document.
Qui le mettent en page.
What is someone who... editors were at work and they changed or they added certain standard phrases to almost every paragraph. It was as if there had been a rule. In every paragraph we must say something about women, girl children and people with disabilities. So you found the same text repeated again and again. It was a very idealistic document. It had both socialist and neoliberal elements. But very quickly the neoliberal elements won out. And the RDP was replaced by something called GEAR, growth, equity, and I can't even remember what it is called. It's already been dépassé. But something which took on board the basic Washington consensus that you build an economy by having a small government and by having that trickle-down effect, where if you let the wealthy people get wealthy, then they will spend a lot of money, and that will mean that jobs are created for the poor, the trickle-down effect. That's the theory behind it. And unfortunately, the leadership of the ANC took this on board. That doesn't mean that a lot was not done. There is a huge backlog of housing in South Africa. People are streaming. During apartheid, black people were not allowed to move into the cities, or there was restrictions limiting the natural movement of people in developing countries towards the city. Urbanization was being blocked by apartheid legislation. When apartheid ended, there was a huge influx of people into the cities, living in slums, bidonville, who needed to have housing. So RDP houses were built, but RDP houses have a very sour taste because in many of the cases the houses were built by corrupt construction companies, and so in many of these houses have already fallen down or are practically uninhabitable as a result of the poor workmanship, the poor construction, the corruption and so forth that unfortunately occurred during this process. But there are these RDP houses, and they are, of course, for most people a step up from living in a cardboard or a wooden or a plastic or a corrugated iron shack. What about libraries? Now, libraries generally do not have the same priority as providing housing and health and clean water and sanitation and so forth. And a number of policy processes were taking place during the 1990s, in which I also participated, where parts of the ANC, both as a party and as a government, were busy planning for the new education system and also for new arts and culture and policies. And all these policies were being developed without any inputs from libraries at all. So now you imagine people doing planning for school, for schooling, primary school, école maternelle, toutes les écoles, universities, colleges. People were doing planning for cultural development of the country. And in none of these cases did the people responsible think of including libraries in those processes. But we librarians, we became thick-skinned and hard-nosed, and we pushed our way in. That was the phrase we used. We inserted ourselves into these processes through contacts and through, particularly through political contacts, colleagues who were well within the ANC. And there were three of these processes that I've listed on here In each case, they started off without any input from librarians, and in each case, they ended up with a chapter dealing with the role of libraries in schools, in education, and in arts and culture. And I was very involved in that. It took a huge amount of time. I drafted myself the chapters on libraries in the last two of those documents. It took a huge amount of time, and then nothing happened. Nothing happened at all. But suddenly, in 2005, we got a new Minister of Arts and Culture called Paulo Jordan, and he announced in Parliament that they were going to give 1 billion South African rands for the development of public libraries over a three-year period. That's about 90 million euros. That's a significant amount of money, I think, in most developing countries. And so here we have one of the results of this this process, a library built in a little town called Klaarstoom in the Karoo, in a dry, semi-desert part of South Africa. It's not an impressive building. It doesn't look particularly nice outside, but notice that it has electricity and that there's also a telephone line attaching it to the rest of the world. And here it is inside. It's quite a sweet little library. Not great, but at least there is a library there. And so quite a few hundred, if not 500 or 600 new libraries have been built in South Africa over the last 10 years or so. In various parts of South Africa, particularly to serve the poorer parts of the population. And there's also a very grand library, the National Library of South Africa, of which I'm very proud because I was the director of that library until 2003, and I was the director at the time that we put together the plan for this library. I wasn't there when it was completed, but I'm happy to see that this actually happened. So a prestige project, a nation-building project. And then something of which I'm really proud is the creation of a new non-racial library association for South Africa. Not a merger of the existing racialized library associations, but a completely new one, which was open to all, and which is open to people regardless of their qualifications as well. And that's something that's very important in a country where there's a huge backlog and there's a great lack of qualified people. But things have not been all rosy. Ce n'est pas la vie en rose tout le temps. I spoke about the trickle-down effect. Now, this is not the sort of trickle-down effect that the Washington consensus of neoliberal economists are usually referring to, but this is, in fact, what has happened to a large extent. A lot of the benefits of the neoliberal project have not materialized, and many, many people are still living in very, very bad circumstances. And what has happened is that it's an extremely complex process that has taken place. It has many dimensions. But unfortunately, to a large extent, the capitalist ethos has taken hold of the municipal managers, the mayors, the councillors of municipalities, and other people who are in positions of power, and there's a great deal of corruption. So money is available and money is spent, but the money does not reach the places where it's supposed to go in many cases. Not always. It's not universal, but in many cases this is happening. And as a result, we are having almost every day in South Africa, somewhere in South Africa, there is what is called a service delivery protest. That is where the people in a poor area are sick and tired of waiting for 10 or 12 years for water and sanitation and for their roads to be tarred. And they collect tyres and their pneu, and then they set them on fire with petrol and erect barricades, and then usually they are bagarre avec la police. Pendant ma jeunesse, j'ai étudié à l'université de Caen, et c'est là que je fais connaissance la première fois avec le gaz lacrymogène. Parce que les étudiants aussi ont fait des bagarres sur le campus de l'université. Mais, unfortunately, this is happening almost on a daily basis. If you listen to the road reports, in the morning you listen, if you're driving to work, you listen to the reports which tell you où sont les embouteillages sur les routes. And they will also tell you where there are service delivery breaches, which is a very sad state of affairs. And sometimes there is collateral damage. And in this case, it was the Ratanga Community Library, which of all days was burnt down on Human Rights Day earlier this year. That was in March this year. And I've used this American euphemism, collateral damage, in an ironic sense. So how did the library profession react? Now you can imagine, I think if you are working in a community and you're building up a library, you've started a new library, you've got your building, you've been putting up the shelves, the books have started coming in from the provincial administration, you've got the books organized, the people are beginning to come in and use the library, you've received 10 or 20 computers and you've set up the computers and people are beginning to use the computers. And then the next day when you come to work, the library is burnt down. How would you feel? And I want you to keep that in mind as I show you some of the reactions that have come. And I've taken reactions from the listserv of LIASA, the Library and Information Association of South Africa, that people wrote after these things happened. And when you read them, please bear in mind the emotion that is evoked by this kind of sight. So the local branch of LIASA, that is the branch where this Ratanga Public Library was situated, il n'est pas nécessaire de lire tout le texte, mais seulement prenez note des mots que j'ai relevés en rouge. Just to give you a sense of the... I think we need to analyze these texts to see what are the themes that are playing in the minds of the librarians. They're disheartened. They feel that how is it possible that people can burn down something which is the cornerstone of our democracy, which leads people into the knowledge economy. Note how these tropes, these ideas of knowledge economy and cornerstones, how they have permeated the discourse of librarians. Playing a critical role, the nation building theme, development, and then also note how they appeal to their professional ethos and objectives, their ethos and objectives as members of the library profession. And of course the saddens our hearts part. Another individual comment, a very fierce one, I think, from someone who's really angry. Note how she's pointing a finger at, I know all these people, of course, but I'm not going to tell you who they are. A very fine person. She's talking about them. What is it with people today? How do they believe that burning down the library? And then something really kind of scary and dangerous. She's talking here about the same thing that those things that were happening during the time of the struggle against apartheid, reminiscent of the days when the schools were burned down and then children didn't have anywhere to go to get educated. Some of the rhetoric, which reminds one of the rhetoric of the apartheid regime, is emerging in this piece of text here. Shame on the arsonists. So the people who burnt down these libraries are described as arsonists. Another one.
What is arsonist?
Une personne qui met le feu à quelque chose. Incendieur. Continuez. S'il y a des mots que j'utilise que vous ne connaissez pas, n'hésitez pas à me poser des questions. So you see, what I've done here is I've highlighted some of the language that is used in the discourse of librarians when responding to this particular situation. And then there's the official statement of Lyasa, which is a little bit less emotional, which occurred already quite a few days after this happened. But note the words of loss, shock, appalled, ironic, sad, a lot of emotion even there. And then in the as part of the press release of the Lyasa, a formal response of the Library and Information Association of South Africa, they refer to the loss in terms of the number of books, the number of computers, the facilities that were destroyed, and then also pointing to the services that were being delivered to that community. Now, there's 70,000 residents, and they had 11,000 books. So clearly this is not a library up to French or European standards for public libraries. But yet if you look at the facilities that were offered and the usage made of it, it was a significant contribution to that community. So some of the themes that we've seen as we looked at the red text, the strong language, the horror, the shock, sadness, people are disheartened, condemnation, disgust, and then of course incomprehension. Pourquoi? Why do they target libraries? And then on Human Rights Day and National Library Week, vous avez aussi une semaine de bibliothèque conférence chaque année, non? Non? Pour l'introduire.
La semaine du livre, mais pas la semaine du livre.
They refer to the cost, the financial cost. They refer to the loss of a facility to the community. They talk about what libraries contribute. And they also mentioned, I didn't highlight that in the text I gave you, they also mentioned how important it is to market the library. We must make the community aware. We must market the library to the community. And then something which is not so obvious if you're reading these texts is this gap or this difference that is appearing here, je fais un peu de déconstruction, this gap that is appearing here between us, we, librarians, professional, we have our objectives, our ideals, four communities, and them, who did it? And these are the questions that arise, is who actually did this? Are they arsonists? Is it a small minority of people in the community? Is it community members or people from outside? And then also, perhaps in France, I should also attempt to discuss what is meant by the word community. Parce que Raphaël m'a dit à Helsinki que le mot community n'a pas un équivalent exact en français. It's a group of people in a village or a town who have some sense of interaction, have some relationships with one another. And some of this rhetoric here about they and the arsonists and the small minority is very uncomfortable to me because it recalls the responses of the apartheid government to similar incidents that took place 20 years ago. 25 years ago, particularly in the 1980s. We were always being told by the government that the people who do these things are just a small minority, that they have been influenced by communists and other wicked people, and that the community itself did not want this to happen, that people were forced to participate in these events and so forth. What worries me is that we're seeing the same discourse taking place today. So the librarians, in their search for explanations, have come up with really two rationalizations. The library was in the wrong place at the wrong time. So the library wasn't actually targeted as a library. All the municipal offices were being targeted. Clinics were burnt down. The homes of the mayors and councillors were being burnt down, the symbols of authority. And the other rationalization, that it was a small minority, not a representative of the community that did this. I think that a lot of that is whistling in the dark. Or what is whistling in the dark en français? On essaie de se conforter, on essaie de se donner courage et de se conforter, réconforter, mais en effet, je crois que ces explications ne sont pas valables. C'est trop superficiel. So here we have also, very interestingly, and to my great disappointment, I discovered, having lived overseas for quite a long time and only come back to South Africa last year, that a lot of my library colleagues had not heard about this study of township protests. The scholarly analysis had been done back starting in 2008 and published in 2011 by a team of researchers from a non-governmental organization, ONG, and l'Université de Witwatersrand, ensemble, and these people, Karl von Holt, Malasi Langa, Sepetla Malapo, and a whole lot of others, about 7 or 8 authors together, put together this report, which they called The Smoke That Cools, Insurgent Citizenship, Collective Violence, and the Struggle for a Place in the New South Africa, which was published in 2011. Now, you may want to know why it's called The Smoke That Cools. Why did they title this The Smoke That Cools? It came from an interview with a woman who explained why they set fire to buildings. It says the mayor and the councillors and the structures of the party don't listen to us. They ignore us. It's only when we set fire to things and they see the smoke that they come to pay attention to our needs. So the smoke calls them. Very powerful metaphor. And the aim of this research was, this scholarly research was to understand this collective violence and the underlying social dynamics, and to probe and understand the repertoires and meanings of collective violence. What did the psychologists in this team, not only sociologists, they tried to find out what did this mean to people to set fire to buildings and do these things? And they tried to relate this to local associational life. What groups were there in the communities, in the local areas? How did this fit in with the system of local politics? And then they had a very interesting attempt to relate this to new process of class formation in South Africa. In South Africa, we had a race-based class system. The whites were the top class and the blacks were the bottom class, and the brown and the yellow brownish people were sort of in between. So there was a stratification by colour, if you like. But something different is happening. A new stratification is taking place. So they looked into that as well. And they did very interesting qualitative research. I suppose that you do courses in research methods in the school, and that you're familiar or have heard of or will hear of qualitative methodology. This methodology involved 8 case studies that are of this violence that took place in 2008. And I need to explain what is implied by the term xenophobic violence. La xénophobie, je crois, c'est un mot français aussi. In South Africa, the population is around 45 to 50 million South Africans, and about 5 million of those are people who have come into South Africa from the rest of Africa without papers, basically. Refugees, economic refugees, political refugees, and some of them have been very successful. The Somalis, for example, are very good business people. They've set up shops in all these poor areas, and people are jealous of them. People resent or they envy the success of the Somalis. And so every now and then when there's unhappiness in a community, this is vented in the form of xenophobic attacks on foreigners. And there was a period at which very, very serious xenophobic attacks took place, in which hundreds of people were killed and something like 200,000 foreigners actually were displaced from their dwellings and from their shops. Another way in which this manifests itself, by the way, and this happened in France in the 12th and 13th century and still happens in South Africa in very rural communities, is witch hunts. another attempt to explain or to come to terms with the frightening and rapid social change that is taking place around people is they blame things on witches. And I think it was Michelet, or who is the famous French historian who wrote a whole story about witches in France. So to come back to the methodology, they identified key people with whom they spoke, and from them they heard of other names, and they followed those up using a sort of a snowball process. And they also employed participant observation. So they attended meetings of political parties and rallies and parties, and, as the one guy said, hanging out in taverns, which is a tavern is an informal drinking place, not an official drinking, licensed drinking place, but an informal, illegal drinking place, and home. So that was the methodology used. And so what are their conclusions? They attributed a lot of this, or they related a lot of what was happening to the rapid processes of class formation that are happening in South Africa. A new elite of very wealthy people is emerging, people who have power, possession, lots of money. But at the same time, there's a large underclass of unemployed and precariously employed people. Precariously employed, ce sont des gens qui ont de l'emploi de temps en temps, mais il n'y a pas un emploi permanent, ou, you know, they're sort of living on the fringes of employment. And then, of course, this overlies, underlying this, is the whole dislocation of the transition from apartheid to democracy. Because freedom is scary. Freedom is frightening. You go to Eastern Europe, you'll find so many old people who felt more comfortable under the old communist regime because they were told what to do. They didn't have to make decisions for themselves. So, and there are other things. There was a different kind of safety net for people then. And as a result of these processes of class formation, where you get this growing gap between a very wealthy group and then this large underclass of people, you also find struggling over inclusion, being included in a group or not excluded in a group, within the elite, between the elite and the underclass, and among the underclass people themselves. Very interesting in this report is the analysis of this whole contestation, of the meaning and the content of citizenship. Qu'est-ce que ça signifie d'être un citoyen? La citoyenneté. And what they're talking about there is they see what is happening in South Africa. Everybody is now equal. Everybody can vote. Everybody is free and equal. Égalité, liberté, etc. Comme en France. But there's citizenship, nevertheless, is differentiated in terms of treatments, rights, and privileges. Differently, people are equal but also not equal. Some people are more equal than others, according to differences of education, property, race, gender, and occupation. And race is still very much a factor. The vast majority of white people are still very much wealthier, have far more resources than the vast majority of black people. And when we talk about these problems of race, of class formation, we should not forget that there are still huge imbalances in terms of access to resources among the different races as well. And so what the subaltern, the underclass groups are doing is what they call mobilizing an insurgent citizenship. They are not rejecting their citizenship, they are affirming their citizenship, but they are affirming it in a violent manner. And what they're doing, of course, in South Africa is they're adopting violent practices that developed during the struggle against apartheid in the 1980s. That's still very fresh in people's minds. And in the conclusions also, they said that although we are seeing people affirming the citizenship, and that as such is probably a positive thing, there's also a darker side to this. They see a patriarchal prejudice is appearing, particularly male-dominated discourse. xenophobic exclusion, the xenophobic attacks on the Somalis and the other foreigners in South Africa, the use of violence in political and social disputes, and to buttress local power. This is all very nice, neutral, objective language, but if you read the actual report and you read the case studies, in many of these cases, a lot of this violence was actually associated with power struggles within the African National Congress, fighting for power in a particular community. And then they're warning us that these community protests, collective violence, and the associational practices that underlie them are ambiguous and contradictory in the implications for citizenship and democracy. So having a vibrant associational life, having clubs and groups and societies and associations, is part of democracy. It's something that was admired in the United States in particular. But this can also go over onto un côté noir, you see, into wrong things. Now, we librarians were puzzled why libraries are targeted, and this question also was posed by the researchers themselves. They also wondered, they also thought it was strange that some libraries were burnt down, and they have devote a short section of this report to this. And they found that when they asked people in the communities about why the libraries had been burnt down, quite a lot of them said, no, this was wrong, it was an accident, they were actually targeting something else. You see, they wanted to target the office where the taxes are collected, or, you know, a very unpopular office in the municipality, and then the library happened to be next door or was part of the same building, and the library got burnt as well. That was one explanation. The other explanation is where particularly younger people said, well, this is not a proper library. We were justified in burning the library down because it was not a proper library. You go to the library and there's no newspaper, nothing. There's no internet. That was not a library. What we burnt down was just a room. We burnt the place down so that they would build us a proper library. That thing was there when we were born. Now, and then, how true is this? Is this an ex post facto rationalization? Because we saw that quite a lot of the libraries that were burnt down had computers and had quite significant facilities. In one case, a library was burnt down, but not before the 20 computers that it had were first stolen by people who did the burning. So it's difficult to weigh up. And as I say, the findings are contradictory and the views of the communities are ambivalent. And they conclude, really, that burning down a library or a clinic has different meanings for different actors in a community. For some, a library or a clinic or whatever is an important facility. It has amenities for the public, even if it's not adequate. And for others, the inadequacy of these facilities shows that nothing has changed, or little has changed since the end of apartheid, and the government is failing the community. And so they see a continuity between the apartheid past, when there were these very inadequate facilities, and the present, when there are still inadequate facilities. And so they are burning down libraries and clinics for the same reason that the libraries and clinics were burnt down in the 1970s and 1980s, because they were symbols of authority, they were symbols of a repressive regime. And they are trying symbolically to disrupt the authority of the government. So I have to end with a question: can we learn from this as librarians? And I don't think I have the answers. I have only a few suggestions. I think, first of all, this is clearly bigger than libraries. This is not something we can solve by having a marketing campaign. Quite frankly, I think that a lot of emphasis in librarianship on marketing — I'm going to tread on someone's toes here, but I'll do it all the same — a lot of the emphasis in libraries on marketing is misplaced. It's a refuge from reality. And in this case, I think the librarians who think that we can solve these problems by marketing the library better are probably wrong. That's my view. But if this thing is bigger than libraries, and that librarians can't clearly solve these problems themselves and stop library burnings by themselves, we have to accept that libraries, if libraries are to be relevant, they must be part of the community, and they must be part and will be part of the political process. You see, librarians have a problem in terms of their image in many countries. Libraries don't often hit the newspaper headlines. Libraries are not often referred to in parliament. Libraries are not often the subject of protests and elections. And that's quite nice because it leaves us quietly to get on with our work. But at the same time, it means that because we have that low profile, we don't get very far with the work we want to do. So we have a dilemma. Either we get a public profile and get really up there in front and in the middle, up front and center, or we stay somewhere on the sidelines and we don't attract much attention. But I think if libraries are to be relevant to communities, they have to be part of the community and they have to be part of the political process. And this whole idea about the library has no politics, no religion and no morals, the so-called neutrality that was so strongly emphasized in American librarianship, I think we need to look at that afresh. Can libraries and should libraries make a difference to communities? Can they differentiate themselves from the municipal bureaucracy with which they are confused in the minds of the public? And can and should they be subversive agencies? There's some of my colleagues in America who are sort of leftists and into this social responsibility as a wing of librarianship, and they say libraries are essentially subversive agencies because they allow people to question and subvert the status quo and to question the accepted ideologies. And then, if we're talking about libraries, what about librarians? Can librarians become politically aware? Can we shed our bureaucratic mindset, which I think in many cases characterizes librarians? Can we start deconstructing the managerialist and marketing rhetoric that we use as a kind of a smokescreen or a shield to protect us from uncomfortable truths and realities? And can we align ourselves with the people? Boy, what a big question. What a lot of rhetoric here. So there are no quick fixes. There are no easy answers to this. But I do think that we as librarians need to start studying these things really and getting to grips with them. In South Africa, as I said, we have lots of people doing theses and dissertations on marketing and on various managerial things and on all the wonderful IT stuff that we can do. Nobody is studying the burning of libraries, which is, to me, a very existential issue for our profession. So there are no quick fixes, but I do think it emphasizes how important it is that librarians in their education should learn about the community dynamics and should be involved in politics and be aware of political matters. Thank you.
Merci beaucoup pour cette très intéressante intervention. Est-ce que vous avez des questions? Allez-y,
oui.
Si vous préférez. Vous parlez des bibliothèques en général, des bibliothèques. Quand vous dites celle qui avait volé, c'était une grande bibliothèque?
Non, c'était des bibliothèques de publiques dans les villages, dans des bidonvilles, dans des faubourgs, pauvres en général.
Et vous n'avez pas. Que vous n'aviez pas réussi à
déterminer qui est-ce qui avait brûlé la bibliothèque et est-ce que vous savez le retour des gens, enfin, vous savez ce que les gens pensent des bibliothèques en général? D'abord, il faut constater qu'il n'y a pas ce qu'on appelle une culture de lecture. Naturellement, il y a des gens qui lisent beaucoup, mais les bibliothèques sont publics sont utilisés surtout par les étudiants, qui mènent leurs propres livres et qui emploient cet espace pour étudier. Parce que dans les maisons, c'est trop petit, il n'y a pas d'électricité, etc. C'est difficile d'étudier dans les
disons très souvent. Et à ce point que ils ont les adolescents, les étudiants ont tendance à essayer de pousser les petits enfants hors de la bibliothèque. Il y a toujours une difficulté pour les bibliothécaires de maintenir une sorte de, d'équilibre, parce que les étudiants veulent they want to take over life and use it for selling. Vous avez vu, if you look at those figures, and I can give you, I have a copy of the document which I can give you, can make it available. The number of people being served out of the community of about 80,000 is relatively small, although it's growing. It's certainly growing, and the library is not only a place where people read, it's a place where people can access the internet. And you know, today, even in a country like South Africa, if you do not have access to the internet, you are a second-class citizen. If you want to get a job, if you want to improve yourself, if you want to get access to government services, you can do it without the internet in South Africa, but it certainly helps if you can have access to the internet. And if you can help get someone to help you write a nice curriculum vitae so that you have better success in a job application. So a library is a very important, is potentially and is becoming more and more an agency of inclusion that helps marginalized people to become more accepted into society.
Oui, ouais, je veux savoir justement, et ça rejoint cette question, est-ce que les bibliothécaires ils sont actifs dans cette démarche, par exemple d'aider à rédiger un curriculum vitae ou de chercher sur les bons sites, d'apprendre à utiliser Internet, les traitements de texte?
Oui, il y a des bibliothécaires qui sont un peu bureaucratiques, mais il y a aussi des bibliothécaires qui prennent des initiatives comme ça. Et c'est comme ça que j'ai dit, we have to get rid of the bureaucratic mindset. There's a part of the library profession which is very bureaucratic and is not, we tend to retreat into our corner and just do everything according to the rules. And we must break away from that. And there are very good role models. There are some of these libraries are doing very good work as far as that. But it's a mixed picture. This is not a clear... And there's a very strong tradition in South Africa which comes right back from, I suppose, Dewey, and even further back to Philadelphia, Free Library and so forth, of the library being a neutral place. Librarians do not get involved in politics and opinions and so forth, and we are not supposed to challenge the status quo. That was particularly strong during the apartheid period, and we had some bruising battles within the library profession during the 1980s, where there were some of us who said, "Well, librarians cannot just stand idly by. We have to take the side of freedom and democracy." And that was very difficult for many librarians.
Il y avait une question au fond.
From your professional point of view, should libraries be, you already answered that, should the libraries be more open to the totally different kind of manifestation, like arts manifestation, making professional conferences, etc., in order to be a bigger part of the community, or should libraries just keep doing what
I don't think libraries should be a place to where one should only read books. Libraries have, I suppose my view of a library is of a place where people are connected with knowledge and resources. And that means that in Africa, for example, in South Africa in particular, we have a very high rate of infection with SIDA, HIV/AIDS. Libraries have a big role to play in educating people, not only providing books for people to read about it, but organizing meetings and demonstrations of how to use a condom, if you know, that kind of stuff. Library is a place for that kind of information and knowledge to be disseminated. But of course, not all librarians are comfortable with that kind of thing. There's one library in KwaZulu-Natal where the library is actually placed on quite a large piece of ground, and the library has arranged with women from the local community to use that ground for growing vegetables. And so this library area is a means of increasing the income of the community. The librarian has helped these gardeners to make a contract with the supermarket so that they can sell their vegetables at a good price to the supermarket. And that means income. And of course, the library has books about gardening and all that kind of stuff. So they try to bring people into the library, and we're always still trying to get people to read books. But that's not the only thing that libraries should be doing, to my mind. I think I think it's called Mpumalanga. M-P-U-M-A-L-A-N-G-G-A. Mpumalanga. Il y a un province qui s'appelle de ce nom, mais il y a aussi un village de ce nom. It really means the coming, the rising of the sunrise. Mpumalanga means sunrise. It's east. There's a village in KwaZulu-Natal that has that. And if you can't find it, try on the IFLA website, because it was one of the libraries that was visited in 2007 when the IFLA Congress was held in Durban, South Africa. Yes.
In digital libraries, who are the librarians? Are they members of the communities or are they professionals?
That's a and good question.
By the way, all are librarians trained in South Africa?
That's very difficult to explain in less than half an hour. Different from the situation, I think, in France. Most librarians are trained by doing a four-year university course, which includes courses such as English and History and other general Bachelor of Arts courses, along with a library science and information science courses. More and more of that training now is going into information science and less into librarianship, which I think is a problem given the situation here. That's where the leadership group, as it were, comes from. And then there is another group of students who go through a three-year technicon, used to be called the technicon, it's now University of Technology, a course, and they get a national diploma, which is more practically based. The problem is that in South Africa, like in many other African countries, you take students in and you teach them all the wonders of information technology and web design and all those wonderful things that you can do, and then it's very difficult to motivate people to go and work in poor communities. The whole ethos of our education is tending towards marketing, managerialism, information technology, keeping up this Darwinistic sort of thing about if you don't change all the time, then you'll get left behind and you'll die out. And the salvation for librarians is to become very clever with information technology. That is part of the discourse that I see happening in library schools, not only in South Africa. And then a lot of people working in libraries would be people who only have a school leaving certificate and work under the supervision of people with, depending on how size of the library and so forth. So there are different levels of education. And in theory, the South African system is such that it is possible for a person who starts at one level to move up and ultimately reach the sort of professional, become accepted as a professional librarian. But the Library and Information Association of South Africa, LIASA, took a very important decision in principle when it was founded, not to have any qualification requirements. Everybody who works in the library and wants to be a member can be a member of LIASA. That is because there are so many communities that are still functioning with volunteers and other people who don't have any formal library training at all. Very different, I think, from the setup that you have in France.
And does librarians reflect our communities?
Yes, I think in... Well, you see, this is where the stratification that I refer to is taking place now. For a librarian would have a permanent job and probably his own house of bricks and mortar and possibly a car. So in some ways that librarian, even though he is black and lives in that same town, might be living in the wealthier part of the town. Or, I think as so often happens with librarians, we are sort of in between the two because we're not wealthy, but we are intellectuals or we have intellectual interests, and we're poor like the people, but not quite so poor, and we're not wealthy either. We're kind of in between. Most librarians probably also strive to have a bigger house and a nicer car and all the other things that people want in today's consumer society. But I think there is a... this is a very good question, because this is exactly one of the things that I think one should be investigating.
On va prendre une dernière question, et puis après je vais vous laisser parce que vous avez cours après, donc vous avez le temps de manger. On va prendre la dernière question.
En dehors des réponses que les bibliothécaires essayent d'apporter, est-ce que le ministère dont dépendent les bibliothèques, est-ce que ce ministère a réagi? Est-ce qu'il a donné des pistes, des décrets pour
Non, je ne suis pas conscient qu'il existe vraiment des pistes. Il y a des conférences de press statements qui déplorent ces événements, c'est tout. Il n'y a pas encore une vraie réflexion sur... Et d'ailleurs, ce ne sont pas seulement les bibliothèques qui sont affectées, ce sont les cliniques, ce sont toutes sortes d'infrastructures municipales qui sont affectées. Et c'est it's a very tough problem for the government. A lot of this activity is a vote of no confidence in the ANC government, and so they don't really want to make a big give it more prominence than it has. That's what I think.
J'ai juste une question en lien, justement. Justement, Let Us Black Folks Read, ce qui est marqué derrière la photo qui est derrière vous. Ce message, il est adressé au gouvernement ou à ceux qui veulent...
J'aurais dû expliquer que c'est beaucoup plus ancien. Ça, c'est du graffiti sur les murs de la Johannesburg Public Library. Dans les années 50 ou 60. Mais je crois que c'est encore ironique de l'utiliser ici.
Bien, ce qu'on va faire, c'est qu'on va s'arrêter là. Je vous remercie pour vos questions. Vous avez l'adresse mail là, de Peter Lord. Il y a son site web. Il ne faut pas hésiter à poser des questions. Vraiment, on va continuer la discussion. Je voulais juste vous dire pour conclusion que sachez qu'il y a des bibliothèques qui brûlent aussi en France. Donc les questions qui se posent là, il faut aussi qu'on se les pose nous. Et l'interpellation que nous fait Peter du bibliothécaire qui doit être peut-être plus politique, etc., c'est quelque chose sur quoi moi aussi je vous interpelle en France également. Voilà. Je vous remercie à vous d'être venus. C'est pas le choix. Merci d'avoir posé des questions et merci encore à Peter pour cette intervention. Merci.
Sorry, I spoke j'ai parlé trop longuement, non. J'ai pas laissé assez de temps.
C'était très bien. Je l'enregistre. Il est sur la clé?
Oui. Ouais. Et il y a sur la clé aussi un PDF. Parce que c'est un. C'est un, 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 un a very, very large file with all the pictures.
Okay. Je pourrais le prendre tout à l'heure?
Oui, oui.
Ouais.
Okay. Oui.
I propose we go to eat, and then we can come back, and I will take the reply. On avait la même question. Exactement. Thomas is working with me on the...
I'm in charge of librarian training. Yes.
Uh-huh. That's why the question. And he's working with me with the Librarian Association about fighting against stereotypes. So that's why we have the same question. So maybe you want your...
Can I take this water with
you? Yeah, sure. Yeah,